The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Wednesday, October 2nd, 2019. Coming up on Roland Martin Unfiltered, Amber Geiger gets the same amount of years in prison as Bill Cosby did. And she killed somebody. We'll break down that particular case, and we'll take you inside of the courtroom. Also, another high-profile case in New Jersey. Federal prosecutors wrapped up their hate crime case against ex-Bordentown Township Police Chief Frank Nucera. This is the guy who said, you know what? Trump is the last hope for white people. Plus, my interview with presidential candidate Andrew Yang. Folks, it's ready to have a great show. It's time to bring the funk. I'm Roland Martin Unfiltered. Let's go.
He's got it. Whatever the miss, he's on it. Whatever it is, he's got the scoop, the fact, the find. And when it breaks, he's right on.
judge read the jury's decision as to how many years Amber Geiger will be sentenced to prison for the death of, for the murder of Botham Jean.
The jury having reached a verdict, I will now announce it. We, the jury, find unanimously that the defendant did not cause the death of Botham Jean while under the immediate influence of sudden passion arising from an adequate cause, and assess the defendant's punishment at 10 years imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. In addition, we assess a fine of $0, and it's signed by the presiding juror. Would you like to have the jury poll?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Is there any legal reason why this sentence should not now be imposed?
Not at all.
It is therefore the order, judgment, and decree of the court that you be taken by the Sheriff of Dallas County and safely transported by her to an agent or representative of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. And there you shall be confined until your sentence is discharged. Your sentence will begin today, and you will receive credit for any back time that you had.
Botham Jean's father, Bertram Jean, testified today in quite the emotional testimony.
Mr. Jean, in this photo, what are you thinking when you're standing there holding your wife?
How could that happen to us, our family? How could we have lost both of them? Such a sweet boy. He tried his best to live a good, honest life. He loved God. He loved everyone. How could this happen to him? How could hindsight, what could we have done? And my family's brokenhearted. How could it be possible? I'll never see him again. And I want to see him. I still want to see him. It's hard. I've never experienced a close death in my family. It's hard not hearing his voice.
Joining me now is Tiffany Young, a political commentator who has been in the courtroom every day since the trial began. Tiffany, I want to play this video. Botham Jean's brother also testified, and he said he did not want to see Amber Geiger go to prison. And in fact, when it was over, go to my iPad, please. When it was over, this happened, where he went to her, hugged Amber Geiger, whispered in her ear, "I hope you find Jesus Christ." And what's interesting is I already see a lot of white folks on social media, people like, you know, conservative commentator Mark Davis out of Dallas talk about how, you know, the forgiveness in the courtroom versus the racial revenge. And I said, oh, so if you forgive the white woman for killing Botham Jean, oh, we praise forgiveness, sort of like with Dylann Roof. But if you don't, it's racial revenge. What was your reaction? How did that play in court in terms of when that happened? And also, were you also in court when this happened? Guys, if you go to my iPad, when the judge came off the stand and gave Amber Geiger a hug. Share your thoughts, please.
Yes, so... We have a press conference with the DA going on here behind me right now. But when those moments happened in court, I will tell you it was a tender moment for everyone in court. You already had one of the jurors that was in tears even as the sentence was read. And so as we watched the judge, some of us were kind of confused as to what was going on because the judge spent some time speaking with Amber. And so we were trying to understand what was going on.
But have you ever seen that before?
Botham's brother.
Tiffany, have you ever seen that before? I mean,
never.
I've covered trials.
And I've never seen
a judge come off the bench and hug the person who was convicted of murder.
Correct, and that's what we've said in all the years of the Dallas County courtrooms. No one could recall seeing a moment such as that.
Obviously, what was
And even when...
Go ahead.
Even when the brother came down from the stands, there were some that were commentating as to whether or not that was even appropriate because Amber Geiger was already in custody at that time. And so, you know, there may even be an opportunity for reprimand there because I've heard that that was inappropriate, I guess, from a procedural standpoint. And then the brother has been here at the courtroom today with his Bible in tow. I've noticed that he's been reading the Bible very intently today. So it wasn't necessarily a shocker to me that he did ask for that.
We're breaking up there. Tiffany, I want to let you go ahead. Why don't you go ahead and cover that news conference, and we'll try to get back with you a little bit later. We get also a better signal, okay?
Okay.
All right. Thanks a bunch. I want to go to now our panel joining me right now in studio, Abisha Cross, political commentator, Democratic strategist, A. Scott Bolden, former chair, National Bar Association PAC, also Lauren Victoria Burke, NNPA. Scott, 10 years?
Well, every state jurisdiction is very different.
Prosecutor won 28. Both of John, his birthday was earlier this week, would have turned 28 years old. He was 26 when he was shot and killed by Amber Geiger. They came back 10. That's real on the low side there. And
she'll serve five. Well, could have gotten life.
Right, could have got life. She'll serve five and before she's eligible for parole.
You know, it's interesting. There was a lot going on in this courtroom. Emotionally draining. These are tough cases. This was a murder case, and she was charged with murder and convicted of murder, but it felt like a manslaughter case. Her whole defense was it was a huge mistake and error, and that seemed to permeate what the emotions and what was going on in this courtroom. You just reported that the witness was allowed to hug a murderer. The judge came down off the stand to hug a murderer. That is so rare. I've been doing this for 32 years on the criminal and prosecution and defense side. I have never seen, read, heard, or even known of any other case like this. So something interesting was going on, but 10 years, the hugs, those are inappropriate. And I'll be honest with you, maybe that's Texas justice, but I think the Texas bar or even the Court of Appeals, if you will, may have something to say about that vis-a-vis the judge. I don't know whether it's an appealable issue or not, but they did this in front of the jury.
Right.
When the jury is making a determination on 0 or 5 to 100 years.
Well, first, Amisha, both of John's brother, that took place while the jury was present before sentencing came down.
Okay.
The judge, I believe, that hug came after the jury had rendered their sentence. But
right.
Even still, and here's the deal. I'll go ahead and say it. I think the difference here, she's a cop. The bottom line is you cannot convince me that the roles were reversed if a Botham Jean walked into Amber Geiger's apartment and she's a cop and she's shot dead, that you're going to have this level of compassion. I think what happens is whenever a police officer is on trial, they are given the benefit of the doubt.
Lots
there
of latitude.
Is a whole, I mean, same thing happened in the Laquan McDonald case. It was, oh my God, don't take my husband from our children. All those things you heard from the officer's wife and all the cops testifying. That, to me, I think, what was the driving force.
It's a little deep. I absolutely agree with you. And I was going to say that the other part of this is when we see cases like this, there's always the defense side trying to find something wrong with the victim. Oh, he smoked weed when he was 16, so somehow he deserved this. In this case, you have a guy who, by all intents and purposes, college graduate, worked at PricewaterhouseCoopers. He was someone who led the choir. He was someone who actually had a white woman serve as a key witness for his character. During the trial.
Great family.
Exactly. Great family. Yes, Christian people. We all pray. On that same token, what we see here is someone who, in Amber Geiger's case, went there and acted like she was the victim the entire time.
Right.
Not that she killed somebody,
no, remember,
but that she was victimized.
She was treated that way from the beginning, Lauren. Cops, first of all, took 3 days to even arrest her. All right. Right. And then she turned herself in another county, not in Dallas County. And you had all this. Yeah, absolutely. It was like,
oh, my God, this is so unfortunate, that it was an accident, she was disturbed, you know, she was sexting the guy she was having an affair with, she was distracted, and then she goes into the apartment. It was just a tragic accident. He's dead.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I know people grieve in different ways, and the family should be allowed to, you know, have their moments that they need to have to work emotionally through this, but the whole thing is really a tour of what it is to be African American, you know, in this country for the last 400 years. We are not allowed to get angry. We're not allowed to get pissed off in the same way.
Oh,
and we're supposed to make everybody else comfortable.
Right. Yes.
Everybody else is supposed to be made comfortable. If you remember in the Michael Brown case, the theory was, well, the cop's life shouldn't be inconvenienced that he had shot dead this 18-year-old. Mm-hmm. Like, why are we inconveniencing his life over that? It's the same thing that happened with George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. And you're seeing a little bit of that here. It's not just that she's a cop. She's a petite, white, blonde female. And there's a natural sort of built-in tendency in our culture to have sympathy for that person.
I mean,
so
here,
this idea that she's just
but
sort
she
of...
But she testifies it's also like she was a victim.
She was the victim.
Right.
She was in fear.
Exactly.
And you know what's interesting about that?
I mean,
her
no.
story is BS. Okay, the idea that she accidentally came into his apartment is nonsense, right? And that this should be a manslaughter case is nonsense. Anybody could see through the fact that this is probably a premeditated
But let me
moment.
Tell you, but let me tell you
so
what.
Well, let me tell you the problem with that.
It was the key fob.
But it feels
all the
like
floors
a
look alike.
Let me tell you why.
They all feel alike.
Because most jurors believe that if it's premeditated murder, right, under the law, you can be premeditated within a minute or two, right? The case didn't feel like that, and it wasn't presented that way. It felt like she made the error. The defense narrative on this dominated this trial, despite a strong prosecutor and besides them getting
not the defense narrative, her narrative from the beginning dominated.
And on the stand, she said, but again,
the only reason that narrative was allowed to be present and consistent is because she's a cop.
I think part of it is because she's a cop. I think the other part she kind of spoke to earlier. This is a younger, blonde, white woman.
No. Hold on. I got that.
America.
I got that. I got that. But she's also a cop. And I'm telling you, the leeway we get. I go back to the case. It was in Connecticut. Black guy. Are they Connecticut or Delaware? I think it was Connecticut. Brother, hands. Cop says, get on the ground. Brother gets on the ground. Mm-hmm. Cops kicks him in the head. Mm. Knocks him unconscious. Goes to court. Jury says, not guilty. We don't have the after video. We have the video of him. This is how he's looking. Going to his knees. Making no move towards the cop. Cops literally kicks him in his head, knocks him unconscious. The jurors said, not guilty. This is the reality. I think you mix in cop, 31-year-old white woman, oh, my God, the tears and all of that.
Well,
and people, you
clearly
know
clearly, you have never in your life, as you've already said, seen that type of scene in the courtroom. I mean, raise your hand in here if you've ever seen a judge come down and hug the person responsible for a murder.
We've never seen somebody get shot and killed in their own home while eating ice cream.
Listen, but here's the deal. This is part of the psychology of what you say. I agree with you. Who you call when you got a problem? Somebody breaking in your house or a disturbance in your house? Who you call? The police. Mm-hmm. And they are there to protect and serve, right?
Right.
Who you call when you want them to come to school and talk about Officer Friendly? The police, right?
Right.
Now, when white people call the police, their narrative is they're there to protect and serve. And they look up because they're the last line of defense between chaos and community. When black people call the police, you got a 50-50 shot of making it. Maybe they come and secure the location.
Like in Illinois, when they call the cops and the brother was a bouncer.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And the brother, he had the gun and the cop shot him.
Right.
And
right.
He ends up getting killed.
Right.
And he was the one trying to stop the fight.
And what happened in Dallas when they had a peaceful march and the shooter was sticking and moving and shooting people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the police and the protesters, or peace protesters, were walking and you had all of them had open carry. As soon as that shooting started, what did the brothers do? The brothers dropped their rifle, rifles, handed their rifles over and got out. You know why?
Because they turned into a fire squad. Right.
And the thing, and I want to pull this up because I was looking at this here. So Mark Davis, y'all, is a conservative radio talk show host in Dallas-Fort Worth, and he and I go at it all the time. But you always gotta love whiteness
and privilege.
You gotta love whiteness when black people forgive. Okay,
it's a beautiful thing.
This is a tweet. Jury gives Amber Geiger 10 years. Courtroom sees spirit of forgiveness. Even hugs along the theme of what Botham Jean would have wanted. This display of grace and mercy is in stark contrast to voices crying for racial revenge. Genuinely inspiring. Then he later tweets, let me find this. There's been so much pain in this story. Botham Jean family's literal embrace of Amber Geiger is God's grace before us. Mm. An echo of the kind of man Botham Jean was. And a call to all of us to practice that mercy and forgiveness in our own lives. You got white folks 18 years later still want to kill every damn Muslim because of 9-1-1. I was offended when I heard that bullshit on TV after Emmanuel.
Dylan
all morning, yeah. Joe, and all these shows. Mm-hmm. I was just struck by the tone of forgiveness. After this tragedy, forgiveness. This, Nate, something tragic happens. White folks in America want us. Mm-hmm. Can you just forgive? Can you just? But it's the mercy. Right. But then it's the, so if you don't forgive, right, racial revenge.
But what about when they are the bad actors? Or the bad act occurs to them.
And again, that's my point.
And they want not only revenge, but they want justice. They want death.
Swiftly.
They want swift justice. And
why
they also
do they
want
equate justice
you
with racial
to be
revenge?
Incarcerated.
It is.
You got to be incarcerated.
It is. I don't really think white folks understand, again, this history. It's history where, and what they also, again, don't understand is that our history has been black forgiveness. It's actually been tied to black survival. Mm-hmm. Because when these things have happened, lynchings and other shootings, this tone of forgiveness, can we just forgive? And then, if you say, oh, no, hell no, I ain't forgiving. I think back to when, I think it was either Jimmy Lee Jackson or the four little girls who were killed in Birmingham when King was trying to give this speech. And his one brother stood up and he's like, oh, no, hell no. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sick of this.
Right.
And we can't get mad.
Right. We're not allowed to get mad.
We can't hold a grudge. We can't say, oh, hell no.
Right.
No. You have to forgive.
Also, too, for us to get mad then indicates that we value our lives just as equally as everybody else, which has been something, and you just said it, we have had to survive making sure that the majority, in this case, white folks, are happy. And if they're not happy and they're angry, that has been a problem for us for 400 years.
Hold tight one second. Hold tight one second. I want to go to, back to Dallas. We have Ben Crump, who's with us. Ben, who do you have with you?
I have Attorney Darrell Washington and Attorney Lee Merritt.
I got to ask the three of you. Tom Joyner this morning asked me how many years I think Amber Geiger was going to get. I said 15. The prosecution was asking for 28. how do y'all feel about 10 years?
Well, 10 years is going to be inadequate every time. We believe that Botham's life mattered a lot more than that. But we understand that we've been so close to this family. We saw the kind of love that was expressed by Botham, that was expressed by his little brother, that permeates that family. And because of that, we thought, you know, 99 years would be far too little time. However, 99 years is not going to bring Botham back to that family. There is additional work that needs to go on. We need to continue to push to fight to change the culture. We need to change the city of Dallas. So that's what we're focusing on.
The one thing I said, Roland, at the press conference, everybody was talking about consideration for this white policewoman who killed this unarmed black man in his apartment. I thought about, and you know this well, all the black men who have been wrongfully convicted, who spent decades in prison, why aren't we asking consideration for them, like the white community was asking for consideration, like this policewoman. So We have a lot of work to do in America. We thought, because this was historic with the first conviction of a white police woman of murder for killing a black man, that this was going to be equal justice. But we saw with this sentence, we still have work to do.
And Roland, just to add to that, we were happy to get the murder conviction. However, you know, when you look at 10 years, there are black men who have been sentenced to more than 10 years for selling weed. There have been people sent to prison for a longer time for stealing a sneaker bar out of the store. So, again, we have a lot of work. The fact that we were able to get a murder conviction on a white lady police officer is, I think, is significant in itself. But still, there are major issues that we are faced with in Dallas and throughout this country that we must take on head on right now.
I have to ask you, do you believe that it was inappropriate for the judge to come off of the bench and embrace Amber Geiger? Hold on. Let me rephrase. I'll rephrase. The three of you. I'll rephrase. The three of you have been in numerous cases. Have you ever seen a judge embrace somebody convicted of murder?
Never, not once, not even on Hollywood movies. I mean, it goes even farther. Roland, this case has had so many twists and turns. Just on last evening, we saw a picture of a bailiff actually combing Amber Geiger's hair. I mean, and just to see a lot of the things that took place today, I've just never seen it happen that way. And it wasn't a mistake. She went in there with the intent to kill Bolton when she walked in that apartment. And I think she should be treated as a murderer. We understand that people they forgive people, but at the end of the day, we need to send the message to America that it is not acceptable to kill unarmed black men in their own homes.
The justice system treats police differently. It's not news to anyone. The justice system treats white women differently. It's not news to anyone. This is part of the system that we're working to change, and there's more work to do.
Amber Geiger is 31 years old. Will go to jail, sentenced to 10 years, will be eligible for parole in 5 years, could also get out a lot earlier for good behavior. And I tell people, I open the show this way. Amber Geiger killed Botham Jean, and she got the same number of years that Bill Cosby got in prison.
That's deep.
Roland, these are some very difficult cases. We were looking at the black man, the black police officer who killed the white lady in Minnesota. If I'm not mistaken, he only got 12 years. These cases are so very difficult to get jurors to want to send police officers to prison for a very long time.
Well, actually, remember, the cop who killed Philando Castile had no indictment. The black cop who killed that white woman, he got indicted. They distanced himself, and he got, more than 10 years in prison. The whole police force in the city just ignored. It's like, no, done with you. And in fact, the settlement that white woman's family received was far higher than what Philando Castile's family received.
Yeah.
So again, in this country, a white woman, her life is far seen as more valuable than an African American.
And Roland, it's so deep what you say, because remember the police union in that Minnesota case where that black guy killed the white woman was the first time I ever saw the police union not defend a cop and turn their back on him. So we know it's always about race in America.
Gentlemen, we certainly appreciate it. Thank you so very much. An emotional trial there, and we'll see what her team chooses to appeal. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Roland.
You guys wanted to make a final point here.
I wanted to ask the team whether that 10-year sentence was appealable under the court procedures in Texas at the state level. Don't know whether it is or isn't, and whether either side could possibly appeal that 10-year sentence.
Well, one of the things that when they asked the defense about that, They rarely accepted what the jury offered.
But they did. Right. That should tell you something right there.
No, we're good. They said, no, we're good.
2005, that's without good behavior. And then if she goes into a number of programs like drug or alcohol, she probably gets good credit, good time credit. I don't know Texas law, but you're looking at, man, essentially a manslaughter sentence.
Here's the deal.
Get ready.
Here's the deal.
That's what you'd be looking at maybe 3 to 5 years.
I know Texas law.
Uh-huh.
That works for a white former cop.
That don't work for black people.
That don't work for black people.
Well, it's the same system.
That don't do you. Okay,
no,
all right.
I'm just trying to figure out there's separate systems for black people and white people. The same system helps everybody.
Yeah, okay.
It hurts everybody.
Yeah, all right.
Get ready for the cavalcade of stats on cases where somebody stole a loaf of bread and got more than 10 years.
Yep.
Right. And Kristen Clark, you retweeted Kristen Clark. She already had an example of that.
Yeah, black man who sold drugs and how he spent...
Got 20 years of life served
20 years and only got out because of the First Step Act. Only got out. Right. This is a tweet right here. Right. Meet Amber Geiger, who was served 10 years after murdering Botham Jean in his own apartment. Meet Edward Douglas, who was sentenced to life in prison after being convicted of selling crack cocaine. Mm. He spent almost 2 decades in prison before being released through the First Step Act.
And many more to come. Because that's going to be
many
a
more
lot
examples.
Of...
You could post a ton of examples up there. You know, I'd stop with that
that's
one.
That's what we got. All right, folks, I got to go to a break when we come back. We'll talk about a former cop in New Jersey who said Donald Trump was the last hope for white people. The jury right now is deliberating his case. I'll tell you about it on Roland Martin Unfiltered. You want to check out Roland Martin Unfiltered? YouTube.com/RolandSMartin. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. There's only one daily digital show out here that keeps it black and keep it real. It's Roland Martin Unfiltered. See that name right there? Roland Martin Unfiltered. Like, share, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/RolandSMartin. And don't forget to turn on your notifications so when we go live, you'll know it. All right, folks, you heard me talk a lot about marijuanastock.org. Why? Because we want to keep you informed of investment opportunities that make sense. We've all watched the growth of the cannabis industry. It is now a $340 billion a year market, and it is still growing. It's also being legalized state by state in this country, and things have changing dramatically. Now, of course, marijuana has a good cousin called hemp with a much higher concentration of CBD, which means hemp gives you all the medical benefits of marijuana without getting you high. Until recently, hemp farming was illegal in the United States, practically legal in the U.S., but the 2018 Farm Bill changed all of that. Those who want to grow need land. This is real simple. It's incredible investment opportunities for companies like 420 Real Estate. Their business model is simple. They buy land that supports hemp CBD grow operations and lease it to licensed high-paying tenants. That's right, they are hemp CBD landlords. Now, of course, at 420 Real Estate, they've done something special for Roland Martin Unfiltered family. The original investment was $500, but you can invest as little as $200 in this crowdfunding campaign. You can invest from $200 up to $10,000. All you got to do is go to marijuanastock.org. For more information, go to marijuanastock.org to get in the game and get in the game now. Folks, as we speak, a jury in New Jersey is considering the fate of Frank Nucera, a former Bordentown, New Jersey police chief. Now, he is charged with hate crime, assault, deprivation of civil rights, and lying to the FBI. He's accused of slamming a handcuffed black teenager's head like a basketball, according to testimony, into a metal door jam. He faces up to 20 years in jail and the loss of his six-figure pension, frozen since March as part of an agreement with the New Jersey pension officials. If jurors believe beyond a reasonable doubt, he is guilty of the crime. And the jury left for the day without reaching a verdict and will resume deliberations on Thursday morning. He also sort of has some comments, y'all, on this whole deal as well. And he actually said, quoted as saying, that Donald Trump is the last hope for white people, according to a recording recently played by jurors. This should be pretty damn simple.
This is pretty rare. You had the blue line, and then you have within that blue line, he was taped by other officers in this small police force who were concerned, to their credit, that their chief, they believe, was a racist.
Whoa, Hillary was giving offensive. All of the minorities to get a vote. That's the truth, I'm telling you.
And one of the quotes is, I'm like, you know what? They're going to fool around and make me shoot these N-words, you know, around here. I mean, he was really over the top. And they had like 80 to 100 tapes that they either introduced at trial or could have introduced at trial against him.
Lauren, he told colleagues that African Americans were like ISIS. They have no value.
You know it's bad when
they should line them all up and mow them down.
When the other cops, because cops are, as I don't need to say, I'm very loyal to each other. The fact that the other cops turned him in is unprecedented. I mean, I haven't heard that ever, and that's another thing that we've never heard of in another case.
And the defense, his defense attorneys, part of their defense is, well, that the other people wanted this job, the team, they didn't really like him.
Right, no.
And so this had nothing to do with race. This had to do with them wanting to be promoted over
him. So they made him say all that stuff. Right,
exactly.
Yeah. He was extremely comfortable.
I'm reporting. I'm not endorsing that defense.
But this is the thing that, again, I mean, we can mention just numerous cases. We can talk about when the cops in Florida were recorded using the N-word, the cops in San Francisco. You have black police chiefs in both places who were blasting them. Of course, the investigation of the Facebook, where they looked at 5 or 8 different cities, and they found more than 300 cops, the vile, racist things they were saying on Facebook message boards. And you had 321 cops nationwide who were suspended in St. Louis, you know, in terms of what was happening there. Hell, what they said about an undercover black cop and how the police department abandoned them. I mean, Lauren, look, you got law enforcement family. Black cops say the safest I am is if I got a uniform on.
Yeah, the police department, to me, police work is almost, to me, from a legal standpoint, a protected class. I mean, they have a license to kill, and they can do things, obviously, that civilians cannot.
Their origins would protect a certain class.
Yeah, I also think, though, too, is that what happens...
No, the origins were to snap up people who look like us.
I think...
Slave control.
Right. Italians. I do think, though, that what happens when you do police work... You're encountering negativity and bad people all the time, day in and day out. Even though in this country the stats for violent crime is actually at a 40-year low, still, if you're a police officer, you're seeing the negative thing every single... And I don't know why the profession never really deals with that issue of trying to either cycle the cops out into other places or whatever, because it has its very dilatory effect. It's no excuse for this, obviously, but... Yeah, I mean, they get it into their heads that they're, you know, better than everybody else at some point because they're dealing with the worst parts of our society all the time.
Also, I think what has to happen, Scott and Amisha, is and again, this is where what happens beforehand, and you don't see enough of it. I'm sorry, if I'm going to put a gun in a person's hand who can take somebody's life, your ass going to undergo a serious psychological evaluation.
What?
Because what happens is we hear the stories that the people who are attracted to becoming cops first of all, police officers have a higher incidence of domestic violence. If we want to pull that out, we can. So when you talk about you now are giving somebody who has this edge, who has this whatever you want to call it, now it's like
mentality.
I got a gun,
right?
Yeah.
And the law says, if I felt like you threatened me, I can take you out?
Yeah.
Well, I'm telling the truth or not.
Yeah.
You know, I spent 5 years as a prosecutor in New York City. The other part of that life of a police officer is they develop this us versus them mentality.
Right.
It's kind of consistent with what you said. And so when you draw up complaints from the police, Roland, in New York, this was in the late 80s, early 90s, we would be there all night, 11 to 9, and the police would come in with arrests and they would refer to the people being arrested, and mostly black or brown people, is if we asked them, you know, what was the race of many of my colleagues would say, not what was the race, but were they black or brown? They didn't even contemplate white.
Mm-hmm.
And the police would refer to the arrestees as dogs, mopes, black brownies, if you will. And this terminology that was used to address, whether you were black, white, yellow, brown as a prosecutor, to address those being arrested, was really not only denigrating, but gave you a good sense of what the police thought about people who were, quote, were on the other side, who were being arrested. That needs to be cycled out.
Yeah.
Because at the same time, the majority of the people committing crime, whether it's New York City or Joliet, Illinois, is somewhere between 1 and 10%, not the whole community.
Exactly.
And so when they come to serve and protect, they come to arrest when they come to our
community. The other piece in that is the disproportionate policing in black communities, right? So in New York in particular, they're not policing for drugs in Bensonhurst and Coney Island. Mm-hmm. We all know that drugs are used equally by all the groups, but who gets policed?
That don't look like
it's
us.
It's self-fulfilling.
Because if you already know you're never going to get pulled over, you're never going to get stopped.
Exactly.
The propensity to carry is a whole lot higher.
Exactly. That's right. Exactly. That's right. That's right. So that's another thing.
So that needs to be.
The other piece is that we know that these trainings don't work. Because we're seeing in many cases, even in Geiger's case, she even said on the stand, and they proved it, she had hundreds of thousands of hours of training, specifically in racial justice, in all of these emotive acts, in how to, what you can do to de-escalate a situation. Got on the stand and said she didn't remember any of it.
Well, see, part of this, too, though, is that a lot of jurisdictions have very low standards for police work. In New York and some of the bigger jurisdictions, you do have to have at least 2 years of college or 2 years of military. Mm-hmm. But in these smaller jurisdictions, like Ferguson, you don't need anything.
Because not even in many large cities. Like, I'm from Chicago. Mm-hmm. Chicago just instituted this 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's a very large city with a large police force.
It's the Wild Wild West. That's what you got going on there. So, all right, folks, got to go to a break. We come back. Bernie Sanders off the campaign trail after having a heart issue. Is it over for the 78-year-old? We'll discuss next, Roland Martin Unfiltered. You want to support Roland Martin Unfiltered? Be sure to join our Bring the Funk fan club. Every dollar that you give to us supports our daily digital show. There's only one daily digital show out here that keeps it black and keep it real. As Roland Martin Unfiltered, support the Roland Martin Unfiltered daily digital show by going to RolandMartinUnfiltered.com. Our goal is to get 20,000 of our fans contributing $50 each for the whole year. You can make this possible. RolandMartinUnfiltered.com. All right, folks, the second annual Life, Love, Jazz experience will be taking place in Los Cabos, November 7th through the 11th. Now, if you want to get your package to attend in person, you can do so by going to lifeluxjazz.com, LifeluxeJazz.com. But if you want to actually check out the live stream, you're going to have 14 different legendary acts performing over 3 days. I told you, comedian actor Mark Curry is confirmed, Gerald Albright, Alex Bunyong, Raul Madon, Incognito, Pieces of a Dream, Kirk Whalum, Average White Band, Donna McClurkin, Shalaya, Roy Ayers, Tom Brown, Ronnie Laws, and Ernest Quarles, and more. GFNTV.com is going to be doing the live stream. You can actually get that live stream package for $10.99. That's $10.99. And so all you got to do is go to GFNTV.com to actually do that. So I want you guys to do that. You can get your live stream pass between now and October 30th for $10.99 at GFNTV.com. 3 days of amazing concerts. Don't forget, Roland Martin Unfiltered will be broadcasting from there Thursday and Friday. But again, the live stream pass, live stream pass through GFNTV.com. $10.99 for those 3 days, and so you want to check that out. Of course, GFN TV, this is your world, and it is in your image. All right, folks, presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders was hospitalized yesterday in Las Vegas, underwent a major medical procedure after blockage was found in one of his arteries. He has canceled all of his campaign events until further notice. He was in Vegas for a candidates forum on gun safety co-hosted by MSNBC, but is not participating. They've also pulled their ad buy from in Iowa, and so we'll see how long it's going to be out. Remember, the debate is going to be taking place in 2 weeks in Ohio. Some folks say when you have a stent procedure, it really takes you a month or two to recover from that, to really get out there. Got to ask y'all, I'll start with Amisha, you first. He's 78 years old, oldest candidate on the Democratic side. Joe Biden is 76, Elizabeth Warren is 70, then the other candidates getting younger. This is a day after they announced they raised $25 million in the last quarter, more than anybody else. But if you're the oldest candidate and you have a health issue running for office, I think voters weigh that and say, do I want to support this person? What do you think?
Voters do, and I think that that's really tragic. One, because a health crisis can hit any of us at any age,
right,
period.
Right.
But in addition to that, the timing could not have been worse. again, with the debate coming up, knowing that he's got to get his feet to the ground, we're seeing Warren surge, taking a lot of what would have been some of his base. And he's really, you know, this isn't the time that anybody needs to slow down. We're now seeing Steyer's going to be on the stage next go round. We're also seeing Tulsi Gabbard back next go round. Bernie has a lot that he has to do. One of the things that was the most tragic to me today was watching people on Twitter on both sides basically shouting it out as almost a sentence of death. I've had people who had stints in my household, relatives, friends, and for a lot of people, they can continue on and be absolutely fine for years. So I think that that's something we have to take into account. But also avoiding being extremely ageist here, again, with full recognition that you can have any type of health scare at any point.
But here's the piece. Lauren is not ageist. The reality is...
He's 78.
No, it's not being ageist. Uh-huh. Jimmy Carter said the other day, he said... I'm gonna tell y'all right now. He said, as somebody who has been president, right. He said, I could not have performed the duties of president of the United States if I was 80 years old.
Exactly.
The reality is, that is on the minds of people.
Right.
I don't care what anybody says. I think back when Paul Tsongas was running, after he had cancer previously, people talked about, and people, a lot of y'all who weren't even born, may not remember where he had this thing where he had the media come out and film him swimming in a pool to show his stamina.
Morality,
2016, Hillary Clinton in the 9/11 commemoration, she collapses, she gets caught. People were talking about her health because, remember, she also suffered the concussion.
Right.
Look, voters factor those things in when you're running.
Yeah, also when you have a big field and half the field is under the age of, like, you know, 60 or 55-ish, right? You got some really young people in the field, like Buttigieg. It reminds everybody as they're standing on the stage how old these other people are, particularly we got Joe Biden standing there as the front runner. My view is Elizabeth Warren's going to get the nominations, going to take all his votes, and just keep on trucking. So I think...
If he stays in the hospital, you know, or if he gets out?
Well, either way, whether he comes out or not. I mean, the polls are not particularly favorable to him right now before any of this happens, so now this is actually a major thing. And if he misses the debate, that's going to be a moment. I think he's okay. I mean, we're not... It's not that we're not... It's not a bad thing of timing, but if this was, like, you know, a week before the South Carolina primary,
if this was January,
you know, January,
that's a whole different deal.
But
again, it what it does is, for the calculus of people who are determining who they want to support, who they want to get behind Scott, these are things that they actually factor in.
Well, it's fair game, but the reality is, I was thinking while you were talking about your family members, I was thinking about your family members, though, aren't running for president, and the amount of stress these candidates are under, whether they're young or older. They're traveling every day. They're eating poorly, probably. They're probably not exercising.
Sleep patterns, all that.
Sleep patterns. This is stressful. This is stressful stuff. And I'm not a doctor, but if something's wrong with your arteries, a lot of it has to do with your lifestyle.
Well, hell, you look at Obama. Obama came to the White House with black hair. And he left damn near silver. I mean, that's just...
It's fair game.
The presidency ages you. And I'm just simply saying that I think that it plays a part in it. It will be interesting to see how fast he's able to bounce back from this.
Right.
Because how soon does he get back on the campaign trail?
Right.
Yeah, if that debate takes place October 15th and Bernie Sanders is not on the stage, frankly, what it does is, not only have a shrinking field, it really gives an opportunity, frankly, for Senator Elizabeth Warren, for Senator Kamala Harris, for Mayor Pete Buttigieg, for those people who are in that second tier, opportunity for them to say, okay, now how can I go up? How can I sort of seize the moment?
If he's
back,
ready...
He don't stay away from that boxing ball he tried to do to show that he had the vigor to run.
But I mean, if he's ready in 12 days, I'll be shocked. He'd be ready in 12 or 13 days.
He got a step. He got two steps.
He had heart surgery.
Really, basically.
Let's not. If he's sitting down on that stage in 13 days, I'll be shocked.
But people also questioning Donald Trump's health? Mind you, he's somebody who we all know is overweight. Somebody who eats like trash.
It's mental health. Every day we question it.
Got a non-White House doctor to actually...
The greatest doctor, the greatest health of all time.
First of all, we're dealing with an absolute loon. Anybody who saw the news conference today will understand the kind of nuttiness we're dealing with when it comes to Donald Trump. All right, folks, first of all, here's the deal. So I want to thank Amisha, Scott, and Lauren as well. Now we're going to end the show with this here. My interview with Andrew Yang. He raised $10 million in the third quarter of 2019, according to his campaign. That's substantially more than the $2.8 million he raised in the second quarter of this year.
Last week, I sat down with him to talk about his agenda, what it is for African Americans, and talk about, of course, his $1,000 check that would go to all Americans. Y'all get a chance to do that. Also, don't forget, if you want to support Roland Martin Unfiltered, some of you have already been giving through the YouTube channel. Do so by going to RolandMartinUnfiltered.com, by joining our Bring the Funk fan club. Matter of fact, Andrew Yang, why don't you send some of that $1,000 a month over here? What the hell? Might as well. I mean, what the hell? I'm
you
just saying.
Do that and have interviewed him too?
Hell.
You're a member of the media.
I got no problem with Biden, Harris, Warren. So how many candidates left? How many candidates left? Is 19 of them left? So again, if 19 of you send $1,000 a month, hey, guess what? You paid just about 40% of our expenses.
Have you no shame?
None.
Have you no shame?
None. None.
Where is your decency?
None.
And your ethics?
Guess what? All you got to do is buy some damn ads. Right. Same
all
thing.
All you got to do. Right.
Same thing.
Same difference.
Same damn really? Thing.
You can do that.
Same thing. And guess what? I'll take them.
He got a million people following him.
I'll take them. I got 2.5 million.
Oh,
I'll take them. See, Kappas can't count. All right, y'all.
No, I'm just not as arrogant.
Here's you just can't count.
I can count.
Yeah, you can count.
I went to Morehouse. Can
you
count?
Count the times you dropped them canes. All right, y'all. This is my conversation with Andrew Yang. So let's get right into this. The crux of your campaign is about this guaranteed income, if you will. And a lot of people may not realize that the book, The Guaranteed Income, really formed the basis of the economic policy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, I would be the first to give credit to Dr. King and people who've come well before me. Sometimes people falsely believe that this was my idea. It's not my idea at all. It's something that Dr. King championed and advocated in his 1967 book, Chaos or Community, and it is what he was fighting for when he was assassinated in 1968. To me, it's unfortunate that we celebrate his birthday every year without really talking about what he was fighting for. It's almost, in my mind, it's like his memory has been sanitized and made uncontroversial in a way that, in my mind, is not what he would have wanted.
Well, and what people also, again, those of us who actually followed Dr. King may not realize is that that this notion of a guaranteed income was a particular book that he read. And I was talking to Al Sampson, Reverend Al Sampson out of Chicago, who was one of only two ministers who was actually ordained by Dr. King. And what he laid out, and I actually got a couple of copies of that book, is called The Guaranteed Income, Next Step in Economic Evolution by Robert Theobald. Dr. King read that book, and then that's what he really began to lay out. And so how would this work in 2019? So explain why this makes sense as opposed to what we currently have is, you know what, people say that this would be a handout, this would be welfare, this is just be giving folks free money.
Well, if you look at our country, there's actually a dividend in effect right now in Alaska, where everyone in Alaska is currently getting between $1,000 and $2,000 a year in oil money. And what I would argue to the American people is that at this point, technology and data are to the 21st century what oil was to the 20th century, where these are common assets that are generating huge amounts of value. And the American people, certainly we should own our own data, but also we should be participating in the incredible benefits of the 21st century economy. Instead, you have a $1 trillion tech company like Amazon closing 30% of America's stores and malls and paying zero in taxes. You have Google and Facebook and Uber who are paying very little or no taxes. Netflix pays zero taxes. So we're in a bind because the biggest winners of the 21st century economy are paying nothing back into our system while our economy is being transformed forever by these self-same companies. So to me, this is a necessary move in order to allow us all to prosper and participate in the modern economy. And when I was researching this proposal, I realized that Dr. King was prescient, where a lot of the issues he was talking about in the 1960s actually revolve around how technology was automating. At that point, it was manufacturing jobs, but now it's become even more powerful and pervasive.
Well, one of the things that also I find to be real interesting as we sort of talk about this is there are people who say, Andrew Yang is supporting, he's supporting handouts, yet you have farmers who have received $28 billion from the federal government because of Donald Trump's tariffs spat, and that's not loans. That's $28 billion in grants when the bailout was $12 billion, and that was actually loans. The federal government actually made money from that. So it's amazing to me how America has no problem with that handout or the subsidies that go to farmers, but then say, oh, the rest of you, you're just trying to get welfare. You're looking for a handout.
Well, Roland, what about the $4 trillion we printed to bail out Wall Street? I mean, that's T, trillion. So when the banks needed the money, we were there. You know, when the banks made bad decisions, they didn't have to face the consequences of those decisions in real ways. Whereas for individuals, somehow it's the individual's fault. And this is something that I think most Americans are savvy to, that framing things as, pull yourself up from your bootstraps no longer makes much sense, given that you have large corporations who are the recipients of billions of dollars in some combination of subsidies or tax breaks or bailouts.
So how do you plan to, though, break through? You're still in this race. The Democrats have set a new qualifying mark for the next debate in October. And so how does this catch on? How do you think you're able to get more people to believe in what you're presenting, as opposed to right now, the top of the ticket is Biden, Warren, Sanders?
Well, a recent poll had me as high as fourth place. I've already qualified for the October debate, and I'm halfway to qualifying for the November debate. So this message is catching fire because people realize that $1,000 a month in our hands would be a game changer for millions of American families, certainly for communities of color who are starting with lower levels of access to education and capital. $1,000 a month, in many cases, would be $24,000 a year in that household if you have two adults. And so the vision is so powerful, Roland, I'm happy to say that our campaign is growing like wildfire. And you'll see, we're just going to continue to grow. I'm somewhere between fourth and sixth right now, and I've got a big up arrow attached to my campaign where I'm one of only two campaigns that's grown consistently the entire time.
If we going beyond this $1,000 a month, what would you articulate is your black agenda, specifically for African Americans? Let's say when it comes to education, let's say when it comes to access to capital for businesses, let's say when it comes to criminal justice reform. And so what does that look like? Why should African Americans say, hey, I want to give Andrew Yang a shot?
So let me say that the freedom dividend, that would be an enormous game changer for millions of American families and families of color. It does not somehow balance the scales where African Americans are concerned. So we need to do much more. On the criminal justice side, I would close private prisons. It makes no sense to have prisons that have a profit motive, that benefit from recidivism. I would get rid of this punitive cash bail system that's essentially criminalizing poverty for many, many Americans. I would legalize marijuana nationwide, and then I would mass pardon everyone who's in jail for a nonviolent marijuana-related offense, which I have a feeling we all know everyone would be black, and I would high-five them all on the way out of jail.
So let me ask you about the marijuana piece. But before we go forward on the other issues, on the marijuana piece, there are some African Americans who believe, and I've heard this for different states, who believe that there should be set-asides for people or African Americans and others who were most impacted by those marijuana laws. Of course, when some of these states have passed these laws, now you're talking about a $340 billion global industry. We see the billions that are being earned in Colorado and California and Washington State and other different places. And so there are some black there's some black caucuses on the state level who are trying to hold up, saying, no, we need to ensure that people are not getting left out. They don't want African Americans left out with this whole deal legalizing marijuana. Would you support creating something where those groups of individuals who are most impacted by marijuana laws, or even allowing individuals who did serve time not to be disenfranchised by the legalizing marijuana, so they can benefit economically from what is now legal?
I would support that. It's only just that the community that's been most adversely impacted by what I see as the inequitable enforcement of our drug laws would then be in a position to benefit when you have a multi-billion dollar industry that's taking shape. So to me, the secret to everything in my mind, Roland, is that black entrepreneurship will flourish when black consumers have more money to spend.
You were talking about, again, some of the other issues in terms of, if I had to say education, if I had to say education, what would that look like?
Yeah, I have a plan for HBCUs that we have to face facts that the education market is like other markets where it follows the almighty dollar. And you have these very rich schools with big endowments, and HBCUs are on the other end where they don't have those sorts of endowments to fall back on. So we need to bolster HBCUs specifically. I have a multi-billion dollar plan to help shore up HBCUs that have been, by the numbers, very, very successful in their historic missions. So to me, the Freedom Dividend is a starting point. It's a foundation. But we have to do much, much more to make our economy work for people from every background.
I lost some audio right there, and so, but I got you back there. So we talked about criminal justice reform. We talked about education. One of the things
Roland, and I saw that you were, you know, you're like me in that you're just pro good schools. You're like, look, as long as you educate our kids, I'm down.
Right.
And I'm the exact same way. The data shows that 65 to 70% of our kids' school performance is determined by out-of-school factors. So that's parental mm-hmm. time spent with the child, stress levels in the household, the type of neighborhood, factors like that. So one of the big problems we have facing black communities is that there's an education gap, and then people say, okay, well, I'll give more money to the school, but the school only accounts for about a third of the kids' performance. So if you want there to be better access to actual education, what you would do is you'd give the money directly to the families and the parents, and then try and improve the in-home environment, which accounts for two-thirds of the kids' performance. We can give money to the schools till we're blue in the face, but as a math guy, if it can only control a third of the outcome, you have to focus on the other two-thirds, too.
Well, and one of the things that I have been talking about this whole issue, and again, it's amazing to me when people go, well, you know, why are you supporting charter schools? And I'm going, folks, there cannot just be one delivery system in this country. My philosophy is real simple. If traditional schools exist and are working, they stay open, they keep educating. If there's a charter school and they're working, fine. If it's a magnet school and it's working, fine. If it's a home school, if it's an online school, fine. But the problem to me is we got people who are saying, oh, get rid of charters, but I'm going, yeah, but if they're working in places, why would I get rid of something that's working? The other issue that I have a problem with is that schools have become community service centers. There used to be a time when you were in a neighborhood and there was a school here and a community service center down the street. So when you needed health, when you needed dental, when you needed mental services, you went to the community center. Well, cities and counties shut those down. Now they want to turn the schoolhouse into a community service center. So then education is no longer number one on the list. It's now delivering food, mental illness. It's now mental health, now delivering health, dental, and education like five or six. I believe we got to challenge cities and counties to reopen community centers, provide those services to people, as opposed to saying the school should do all of these things. Your thoughts?
I I agree with you on both counts. And I have many friends who are very committed and dedicated educators who are teaching at charter schools. They're just like any other teacher. They're teaching their kids and they're doing their best every day. And somehow painting them with a negative brush, to me, applied across hundreds of schools around the country, you know, does not seem right. And I agree with you that right now we're asking schools to do the impossible, where, one, again, they can only control a third of the educational outcome, and we're saying control 100% and make it happen. As you say, there's a lot of mission creep where it's like, hey, while you're at it, become a social worker, become a health institution, become, you know, a community health org. And you're right that there were other places for that in communities, as there should be. At this point, those resources have been reduced, and that's what we have to reverse. But we don't necessarily need to try and look to the school and teachers and educators as the cure-all. We have to put other people in position to do the work, too, and put different organizations in place that have specific missions.
All right, Andrew, got to ask you this question. This has not come up in a lot of these debates. Housing. I've covered housing my entire career. The reality is black folks lost 53% of all wealth during the housing foreclosure crisis. That has impacted the ability to be able to get small business loans. But also what we saw were these hedge fund companies aligning with these banks, buying up 25 and 30 and 40,000 blocks of homes. So what is your housing plan for America?
You are 100% right to trace this back to the financial crisis, Roland. What happened was, in the run-up to the financial crisis, you had predatory lending practices that preyed particularly on black communities of color and said, hey, you can buy a home now, and we're going to essentially give you these shady loans, but don't worry, you can afford it. And then they made money going in, and then it turns out these mortgage-backed securities were way overvalued, and so then you wound up crashing the economy. And the U.S. government had a crucial choice in the wake of the financial crisis. They could either bail out the homeowners or bail out the banks. And we know what they chose. They chose to bail out Wall Street to the tune of $4 trillion. And so you saw this wipeout of housing wealth among communities of color in particular that have never really recovered. That, to me, was a real lost opportunity, and that you needed to help keep people in their homes. That housing wealth has never come back for black communities. And so we need to do much, much more to put more people in position to own homes in a way that's sustainable. One of the difficulties in addressing the housing crisis and affordable housing in communities around the country, and I think you live in the D.C. area, which is one of the most expensive areas in the country, and so you see the gentrification. Yep. Is that all of the incentives are around the marketplace, where if you're a developer and you have a choice between building new apartments for yuppies or keeping people in their homes, then of course you choose the yuppies. So we have to do all we can to federalize better incentives for developers so that if they build, they build for people who can afford to live there, they can build for the people that currently live there instead of people that are always going to be moving in. The tough part is that a lot of the zoning regs and NIMBYism are local in nature. And a lot of people talk about affordable housing until it gets to their own backyard, and then they say, not in my backyard. And that's what NIMBY obviously stands for. So there are things that we have to do in a big way, because the federal housing measures are woefully inadequate. I think there's something like a three-year waiting list for housing assistance and whatnot. I mean, 3 years a long time to wait. You know, I mean, what are you going to do, be homeless for 3 years? So there's a lot more we need to do. The immediate term measure is just getting money into our hands, which then would be a massive rebalancer in terms of people's ability to just seek shelter in a positive way. And if you have $1,000 a month and there are four of you, you could band together and just, you know, find a fixer-upper or a house, and it would help create economic incentives for the right kind of development. But then we need a federal housing plan that actually starts to change the incentives for landlords and developers who right now are most interested in sticking it to tenants and gouging us at every turn. You can trace the roots of this back to the financial crisis, though. It's one of the things that changed my entire outlook and career where, in the wake of the financial crisis, I left my job to start a nonprofit to help train entrepreneurs because I said, we can't keep on crashing the economy and running this financialized economy. And then after doing that for 7 years, I realized that it was even worse than I thought. And now I'm running for president to actually rewrite the rules of the economy so that it works for everyone. There's no other way to do this except to get control of the government and just put money into our hands. Everything else we're going to do is just going to be scratching the surface of the problems.
Last question for you. Obviously, Democrats are moving forward with an impeachment inquiry of Donald Trump. Do you support that? And do you think the American people will realize that this president has abused his position in office?
I do support the move to impeach Donald Trump. I've been more or less in lockstep with Nancy Pelosi, where she saw that this might not be a positive outcome in terms of successful impeachment, and it may energize hardcore Donald Trump supporters who believe that the president is being unfairly persecuted. The other thing, Roland, that troubles me is that every moment we spend talking about Donald Trump is a victory for Donald Trump. And that includes if we're talking about impeaching Donald Trump, it's still Donald Trump controlling the narrative, controlling the conversation. We need a new story. We need a new narrative about what we can do for ourselves, a positive vision for the country that gets people excited. That's the antidote. That's the way to defeat Donald Trump. Impeachment, in my mind, is not the antidote that we're looking for. But I do support Nancy Pelosi's move to impeach him because at this point, you have the president colluding with foreign leaders for political gain and withholding aid and then suppressing the investigation. So at some point, if you are Congress, you have to act. I think this was the right move, but I don't want anyone to have any illusions about the fact that this is necessarily good for the Democratic Party, good for America, or that we're going to successfully remove Donald Trump from office.
Well, I make the point all the time that going down an impeachment road is never something that people want to. But at some point, if an individual chooses to be so brazen and ignore the Constitution and flout its laws, that person has to be held accountable. And so we'll see what happens. Andrew Yang, surely appreciate it. Thank you so very much as you're traveling there in New Hampshire.
Thank you, Roland. Hopefully I'll see you in person soon. Appreciate your understanding of my travel schedule, making this like the best opportunity. So thank you.
Well, it's all good. Well, the whole thing is this year. I'm in Lima, Ohio right now, about to give a speech in a minute at a Chamber of Commerce community event. And so I truly understand being on the road, which is also why I love having my own digital platform, because we get to be very flexible with how we do this show.
It's very 21st century, Roland.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. See you soon.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.